Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. This just in, the government of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, based on credible information, confirms that Mullah Muhammad Omar, leader of the Taliban, died in April 2013 in Pakistan. The government of Afghanistan believes that grounds for the Afghan peace talks are more paved now than before, and thus calls on all armed opposition groups to seize the opportunity and join the peace process. Turkish warplanes bombarded Kurdish militants in northern Iraq Wednesday, hours after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said it was impossible to continue peace efforts with the Kurds. Ankara's fighter jets hit shelters, depots, and caves in six areas, Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu's office said. It was the biggest assault since Turkey launched strikes last week against the Kurdish militants and Islamic State fighters in northern Syria. Iraq condemned the air attacks as a dangerous escalation and an assault on Iraqi sovereignty. Mr. Davutoglu has called the fight against the Kurds and Islamic State a synchronized fight against terror. Pakistani authorities said Wednesday police killed the leader of a militant group accused of killing hundreds of Shiites. Officers were transporting Malik Ishaq early Wednesday when the convoy came under attack by a group of men in the Muzaffarnagar. Ishaq's, his two sons and 11 others then died during a shootout with police. Six policemen were injured. Ishaq was the leader of LEJ, an Al-Qaeda-linked group that has claimed responsibility for a number of attacks, including two bombings in Quetta in 2013 that killed nearly 200 people. This is VOA News. Eurotunnel, the company operating the tunnel between France and England, says it has blocked more than 3,700 migrants trying to cross illegally from continental Europe to Britain since the beginning of the year. Eurotunnel announced the total Wednesday, saying France and Britain need to do more to help Eurotunnel cope with the rising numbers of migrants flooding into the area. Authorities in the northern French port city of Calais said Wednesday that during the overnight hours, they counted 1,500 migrants who had tried to enter the Eurotunnel in hopes of reaching Britain. That followed a record total on Monday night when police pushed back more than 2,000 migrants. Another set of U.S. lawmakers get a chance to question and hear testimony from senior officials Wednesday as they continue to evaluate the international nuclear agreement with Iran. Secretary of State John Kerry, Defense Secretary Ash Carter, Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Martin Dempsey are to appear before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Kerry told the House Foreign Affairs Committee on Tuesday that a U.S. rejection of the pact would be squandering the best chance to control Iran's nuclear program and would leave no restraints on Iran developing a nuclear weapon.
If you walk away, year 15 or 20 starts tomorrow. And without any of the long-term access and verification safeguards that we have put in place, what is the alternative? What are you going to do when Iran does start to enrich, which they will feel they have a right to if we walk away from the deal?
Congressman Ed Royce, the Republican chairman of the Foreign Affairs Panel, voiced skepticism about the agreement.
If this agreement goes through, Iran gets a cash bonanza, a boost to its international standing, and a lighted path toward nuclear weapons. With sweeping sanctions relief, we have lessened our ability to challenge Iran's conduct across the board. As Iran grows stronger, we will be weaker to respond.
The U.S. Congress has a 60-day period to review the Iran nuclear agreement. The United Nations Security Council is scheduled to vote Wednesday on a draft resolution establishing an international tribunal to try those suspected of shooting down a Malaysia Airlines plane over eastern Ukraine a year ago. Malaysia, the Netherlands, Australia, Ukraine, and Belgium have expressed their support for such a tribunal. Malaysia has circulated a draft resolution to that effect. Bangladesh's Supreme Court upheld a death sentence against opposition leader Saluddin Qadir Chowdhury on Wednesday in connection with mass killings during the country's 1971 war for independence from Pakistan. Chowdhury is a leader of the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, also known as the BNP, and was an aide to former Prime Minister Khalida Zia. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
As health officials in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone struggle to eliminate the final cases of Ebola, a new report says some hard lessons have been learned. The group, International Alert, says a lack of trust between the Liberian people and their government made the outbreak worse.
That's VOA's Jody Capua reporting. Details coming up.
Also in the news, as many as 10,000 migrants from Africa, the Middle East, and beyond are living in squalid encampments in and near the city of Calais, France. And according to media reports, the Nigerian army repels an attack by the radical Islamic group Boko Haram on Baratai, hometown of the new army chief of staff.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Reuters Newswire reports that a Sudanese migrant was killed early today trying to cross from France to Britain through the tunnel under the English Channel. Authorities say the man was between 25 to 30 years old. He was likely struck by a truck. A Eurotunnel spokesman says that there were about 1,500 attempts by migrants to access the tunnel Tuesday after 2,000 attempts the previous night. Eurotunnel says it has blocked more than 37,000 migrants trying to cross illegally from continental Europe to Britain since the beginning of the year. As many as 10,000 migrants from Africa, the Middle East, and beyond are living in squalid encampments in and near Calais. Observers say their push to enter the 50-kilometer undersea tunnel has intensified in recent weeks after authorities stepped up port security to block migrants from stowing away on Britain-bound vessels.
In Nigeria, the media says the army has repelled an attack by the radical Islamic group Boko Haram on Baratai. The Borno State village is the hometown of the new army chief of staff, Major General Tukur Baratai, and the site of a military camp. Nigeria's Guardian newspaper says the insurgents attacked at about 3:30 Tuesday morning. The paper says the army also turned back an attack on Baratai Monday, and the Guardian says it is the fourth attack on the village since February. The director of Army Relations, Colonel Sani Kukasheka Usman, told the paper that the situation and town is cool and calm.
In a related story, the Daily Trust paper says police defused a bomb yesterday at a crowded market along Baga Road in Maiduguri. The paper says a businessman discovered the bomb and alerted police. Meanwhile, the Sun newspaper says the military on Monday rescued 30 civilians in the Borno central town of Dikwa, which was recently liberated by troops. The army says the hostages were being held in Koyabe and Wuef wards in Dikwa local government. Among them were 21 children, a six-day-old infant, seven women, and two elderly men. An army spokesman says authorities also discovered a shed in the looted palace of the Shehu of Dikwa, where recruits were given weapons, training, and instruction on how to engage aircraft. During President Obama's visit to Africa this week, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, MCC, announced a $70 million new commitment to bring $1 billion in public-private investments to developing countries over the next 5 years. A large portion of the grant money will go to Africa and is expected to generate $750 million in investments in Africa from the private sector. Kay Kim is Deputy Vice President of Compact Operations for the MCC. She spoke with me about how the money will be invested.
The MCC is going to typically invest in large-scale infrastructure projects. It's about two-thirds of our portfolio. Within the infrastructure portfolio, we will help prepare some of the projects for the market such that private companies would find them attractive and be interested in investing alongside some of these projects. And this would result in public-private partnerships that would hopefully increase the effectiveness of the operations and maintenance of these various investments, as well as catalyze private sector funding to help increase the benefits of the public sector investments that we contribute to. An example of this would be something that we did in Jordan with a wastewater treatment plant, where MCC came in with about $93 million in grant financing, and we were able to partner with a private sector consortium that contributed about $110 million. And so with this over $200 million, we're able to expand a wastewater treatment plant, providing increased water supply to the Jordanians.
Are these the same types of projects that you're looking at in Africa as well, or what are some of those investments that you're looking at in Africa?
Yeah, similar projects in Africa where we would be catalyzing private sector investment, particularly for infrastructure. An example of this, we're investing quite heavily in the energy sector, and so there are lots of opportunities for the private sector to come in to contribute to increased generation of electricity in these countries.
Of the $52 million that is going to be generated for Africa, are there any particular countries that you have in mind, or how will that money be dispersed in Africa?
The funding is actually going to be allocated through the compacts, some of our existing compacts, as well as some of our compacts in the pipeline. On that list, our investments in Africa include Malawi, Benin, Lesotho, Liberia, Tanzania, Ghana, and Morocco. There are other countries that we're investing as well, but in those countries that I just listed, those are probably have the largest opportunities for public-private partnerships.
What do African countries need to do to overcome the challenges that they're facing now to accelerate economic growth?
I think our country partners are very good examples of countries that are doing the right things to reduce poverty, increase economic growth, attract private sector investment. These are countries that have a good track record in terms of good governance and democracy, have strong efforts towards anti-corruption, are investing in their social sectors and education and health, as well as creating an enabling business environment through things like good fiscal policy, trade policy. For example, as I mentioned, we're invested quite heavily in the energy sector. We are part of the U.S. government Power Africa initiative, committing about $2 billion to that initiative. In the countries where we work, for example, in Benin, they're working very hard to modernize their policies to allow for more private sector investment, to strengthen the utility companies so that they perform better and perform better for their customers and are also financially viable.
You say you're expected to generate $750 million in investments in Africa within the next 5 years. So given that, where do you see Africa in 5 years in terms of reducing poverty?
I'm 100% optimist when it comes to Africa. When you hear about 6 out of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world are in Africa, I think that there's tremendous growth opportunity there. So I see in 5 years, definitely much more interest by private sector from countries that traditionally have not invested in Africa. And what we're trying to do is really increase the visibility of U.S. companies in Africa.
That was Kay Kim, Deputy Vice President of Compact Operations for the Millennium Challenge Corporation. She spoke with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehisu Heeb, and at 14 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. As many as 10,000 migrants from Africa, the Middle East, and beyond are living in squalid encampments in and near the city of Calais in France. And according to media reports, the Nigerian army has repelled attacks by the radical Islamic group Boko Haram on Baratai, hometown of the new army chief of staff, Major General Tukur Baratai. and would like to hear your thoughts on our stories, you can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Liberia's vice president called for financial support for a sub-regional recovery plan for Ebola-affected countries. Joseph Boakai spoke yesterday at the International Conference on Africa's Fight Against Ebola in Equatorial Guinea. He said for Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone and the region to fully recover will cost about $8 billion. About half of that will go towards the sub-regional recovery plan that includes rebuilding healthcare systems. The Liberian vice president joined the Economic Commission for Africa and the AU in calling for debt relief as part of recovery efforts.
As health officials in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone struggle to eliminate the final cases of Ebola, a new report says some hard lessons have been learned. The Group International Alert says a lack of trust between the Liberian people and their government made the outbreak worse. VOA's Jody Kepawa reports.
The report's author, Ashoka Mukpo, says that many people mistrust official institutions and even feel threatened by them. Mukpo, an American, is an Ebola survivor himself. He contracted the disease last year in Monrovia.
It was a bad couple of weeks. I was very, very sick. I've never been that sick in my life, and I was quite scared.
After being treated for 5 days in Liberia, he was airlifted to a medical facility in the U.S. state of Nebraska. The International Alert Report is entitled Surviving Ebola, Public Perceptions of Governance and the Outbreak Response in Liberia.
You know, International Alert is an organization that looks at underlying dynamics to maintain peace in fragile states. And one of the things we're really curious about with the Ebola outbreak in Liberia is how much did people's perceptions towards government contribute to the outbreak? And what we found when we talked to people is that there were very high levels of mistrust and suspicion towards the government's motives. And this was really what underpinned people's initial refusal to take their warning seriously about how deadly Ebola was.
He says the mistrust stems from history and unfulfilled expectations.
On one hand, Liberia has quite a history of tension between citizens and government. It had a civil war about 15 years ago. But I think right now what people felt is that there was this tremendous sense of hope that with President Johnson Sirleaf's election, this would mean development and accountability for corruption and these kind of things. And the results have actually been quite disappointing. So people are savvy enough to see that what they were hoping would happen hasn't actually happened.
Mukpo says Liberians had expected more from the healthcare system when the Ebola outbreak took hold.
People felt like so many millions of dollars have gone into aid and development over the past 10 years, and for the health sector to completely collapse so quickly, there was this perception that, well, there must have been some kind of corruption, that people were taking money and not putting it into the places it was supposed to go. So fair or not, if you look at the record of this government in battling corruption, it's been so poor that even if there were much bigger issues, you know, with how hard it is to fight an Ebola outbreak, people's perceptions automatically went to corruption.
However, perceptions were not the same for the international community.
You know, actually, I was really surprised by this. As someone who'd lived in Liberia for a few years, I really expected that the levels of trust in the international community would have been equally as low as the government because, you know, I've heard people say, well, you know, these are the folks who support this government the way that they act. But actually, the levels of trust that were given to the international community were much higher than the government. In fact, most of the remarks and most of the reports on the international community's performance during Ebola and just in general its concern for Liberians was very high.
He says one of the critical and underreported narratives of Liberia's Ebola crisis involved community leaders.
Initially, there was this really authoritative effort to quarantine communities and force them to do things differently. And it kind of didn't work. And what really worked is once you sat down with communities and once the government actually got to community leaders and said, look, what can we do to assist you in fighting this outbreak? What do you need from us and what can you do to help? Then once that kind of collaborative effort started, then that's really when you started to see cases reduce.
Mukpo says community trust played a major role in the safe burial of Ebola victims. Touching and washing dead bodies helped spread the disease, despite government warnings against the traditional practice.
Really, when you got community volunteers involved. These are the people whose neighbors were doing these secret burials, whose neighbors were hiding the sick. So it's much easier to hide somebody from an official who doesn't live in your neighborhood than from someone who grew up 30 yards away. And they come and they knock on your door and say, you know, look, I hear your sister is sick. We need to take her to the clinic. And I really think that was the tipping point, that once it was people that folks trusted and that knew had their best interests in mind, that's really when people started to be more cooperative and change their behavior.
The International Alert Report says post-Ebola policymaking and aid delivery must take into account the need to repair the bonds between Liberians and their government in order to strengthen good governance and accountability. It adds that projects that seek to strengthen health services, promote good governance, and rebuild service delivery must incorporate civil society and communities into planning and decision-making. It also recommends that security forces exercise restraint during demonstrations and protests, that anti-corruption agencies be strengthened, and that the Liberian government support a free press and civil society. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
3 days before U.S. President Barack Obama visited Nairobi, Kenya, the city announced it was going to relocate street children to rehabilitation centers in the country. The move coincided with a project to clean up the streets before the president's arrival. As Rael Ambor reports, many say there must be a better way to address the plight of Nairobi's street families.
Humphrey Mashare is on the streets in downtown Nairobi trying to direct a driver to an empty parking spot. The driver comes out and hands him 20 shillings, about 20 US cents, and Humphrey looks for another client. The 17-year-old is just one of the many street boys trying to survive in the city. He says the reason why he came to the streets is his stepfather was mistreating him, so he left home and started his life over in the streets. Like many on the streets, he has spent time in some government rehabilitation centers designed to give street kids another chance. But for many of the street kids, these centers can feel more like detention camps. He says that's the worst place you can ever go. He says you cannot stay there because boys run away all the time and they wake you up too early. After the White House confirmed U.S. President Barack Obama's visit to Kenya, the Nairobi governor announced that the county government had set aside about 16 hectares of land in Ruai, about 20 kilometers from the center of Nairobi, where it intended to settle city street families. The Kenyan government has budgeted only about $30,000 to fund rehabilitation of street families. Activists like Joyce Mudoni, a former street child herself, says life at the centers is often worse than on the streets. She says the rehabilitation centers are dirty with diseases. And she says when she was 12 years old, her body was swollen when she was there. Some private centers are offering another alternative. Francis Kinyo is a program officer at Undugu Society, an organization that deals with rescue, rehabilitation, and reintegration of street children into society. He says that private rehabilitation centers are more efficient than the government ones. At Undugu Society, they use an approach that is more comfortable for the children.
We rehabilitate them at where they are by giving them life skills on how they can manage the trauma that they have gone through and the issue they have faced in their lives.
Street families in Kenya face a myriad of problems. The government has recognized the need to help, but getting the street families the right kind of help is still a challenge. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigeria recently celebrated a year of being polio-free as the threat of the disease continues to decline around the world. Now, Maya Pujara reports that the researchers may have found a positive use for the virus as a way to battle an aggressive form of brain cancer.
It's hard to imagine the poliovirus doing anything but harm, but now researchers are using it to attack cancer cells in the brain. A team at Duke University is using an inactive poliovirus modified by Matthias Grohmeier in a clinical trial to test this therapy.
These are patients that were doomed. their chances of survival were zero without therapy. And if you look at them today, you would not know they were brain tumor patients.
So far, 12 of the 20 patients with a type of brain tumor called glioblastoma have responded well to the treatment. Two of these patients have been cancer-free for over 3 years, which Grohmeyer says is remarkable for people with these deadly tumors. The modified virus works by setting off an immune response inside the cancer cells. That causes the tumor to shrink over a period of several months. But this comes with some downsides.
In all patients, an activation of an immune response will produce brain swelling, and that can cause side effects.
So, Grohmeyer says, the next step in this first phase of the clinical trial is figuring out an effective dose that will not produce side effects. He is optimistic that this approach will eventually be used to treat all glioblastoma patients.
Cancer immunotherapy, which is the most exciting and the most promising development in cancer research, will transform the way tumors are treated in the future.
Glioblastomas, the most common and most lethal of all brain cancers, affect an estimated 240,000 people around the world. Maya Pajara, VOA News, Washington.
Children and young adults who score lower on standardized tests may have less developed brains, according to a new study. As we hear from VOA's Jessica Berman, the authors say the situation may be easily corrected.
It's well known that children from lower socioeconomic backgrounds tend to lag behind their better-off peers in academic readiness and school performance. Now, investigators may be homing in on a biological reason for that difference. A study by researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison found that children and adolescents who tested lower on standardized tests had a lower volume of gray matter in their brains than the norm, and their frontal and temporal lobes developed more slowly. Barbara Wolf, a professor of economics, population health, and public affairs, says those are two critical brain areas.
Critical in the sense that they keep developing until individuals are well into their adolescence or early 20s, and critical in the sense that they are important for executive function, they're important for cognitive function.
Wolf is a co-author of a study that looked at magnetic resonance images of the brains of nearly 400 children and young adults, ages 4 to 22, and paired the scans with the participants' scores on cognitive and academic achievement tests and their socioeconomic status. In general, participants who were low on the economic scale tended to score between 3 and 4 points below what is expected for their age on standardized tests. Those who were significantly below the poverty line had a gap of between 8 and 10 points below the developmental norm. Wolf says there could be a number of reasons for the difference in brain structure and lower test scores in poorer students.
I think it could be nutrition, it could be stimulation, it could be stress that parents face in trying to deal with poverty and putting food on the table.
The authors of the study, published in the journal JAMA Pediatrics, conclude that an estimated 20% of the gap on achievement tests could be tied to poverty. The good news, according to Wolf, is that it may be possible to improve the scores of children and adolescents below the poverty line.
These areas of the brain can be developed so that once we find this, it means that policies can be developed to overcome this deficit.
At the same time, Wolf says improved test scores might be a way to measure the effectiveness of programs designed to boost the academic achievement of lower-income children. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington. Thank you.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. As many as 10,000 migrants from Africa, the Middle East, and beyond are living in squalid encampments in and near the city of Calais, France. And according to media reports, the Nigerian army has repelled an attack by the radical Islamic group Boko Haram on Baratai. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, researchers are working on a spinal cord implant that could one day restore movement in paralyzed individuals. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand Major League Soccer is celebrating its top players.
Kim, we're going to kick off in the Rocky Mountain state of Colorado, where the Major League Soccer All-Star Game will be played later Wednesday night. Joining us now with a preview is VOA's Jonah Haskell. Hi, Jonah.
Hey, Sonny. The MLS All-Star Game will be played Wednesday night in Denver, Colorado, where the star-studded MLS team will take on English Premier League side Tottenham Hotspur. The MLS team is stacked this year, featuring world-class talents like Clint Dempsey, Sebastian Giovinco, and Robbie Keane, as well as league newcomers David Villa and Kaká. English legends Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard were also named to the team but will sit out due to injury, while Sierra Leonean Kai Kamara and Nigerian Obafemi Martins are the African representatives on the MLS team. Martins will not play because of a groin injury, but Kamara is healthy and could be the MLS's biggest threat to score. The All-Stars' opponent this year is Tottenham Hotspur, a team that finished fifth in the Premier League last year and is led by French national team goalkeeper Hugo Lloris, as well as Belgian internationals Moussa Dembele, Yann Vertonghen, and Nasser Chadli. Spurs' goals will most likely come from Togolese forward Emmanuel Adebayor or young English star Harry Kane, who was second in the Premier League with 21 goals last season. And while it is likely to be several years before we see Kane playing in the MLS himself, he has been impressed by the growth of the league in recent years.
We get to watch the games on Sky Sports now over in England, so watched a bit more than what I have in the recent years. But yeah, you can see the level's growing. The MLS is becoming bigger and bigger, and it's attracting big names. And you see the names that we're going to be facing in the game on Wednesday night. It proves that it's getting bigger, and the USA national team is doing very well. They had a great World Cup last year, so I think everyone knows that it's becoming a bigger and better league, and hopefully it continues.
Seattle Sounders star Clint Dempsey will be starting up front for the MLS All-Stars. Dempsey played in England for 7 years before coming back to the States, including spending the 2012-2013 season with none other than Tottenham Hotspur. Clint says he's looking forward to facing his old team and seeing a couple of old friends.
I still stay in touch with Yedlin. But yeah, Moussa Dembele, great guy, great player. Played with him at Fulham. So it's always good to see him doing well. I look forward to seeing him. But yeah, you know, I know some of the staff, but a lot of faces have changed since I was there.
Although the lead up to this match has been friendly, don't expect it to stay that way on the field. MLS All-Stars see the game as an opportunity to show the world the true quality of their league, while Tottenham will be working hard to get set for the beginning of the Premier League season, which is just 11 days away. Tempers flared at the All-Star game last year when the MLS came from behind to defeat a Bayern Munich team that included six newly minted World Cup champions. After the game, Bayern coach Pep Guardiola was upset about several rough tackles by the MLS players and refused to shake the hand of MLS coach Caleb Porter. Tottenham boss Mauricio Pochettino has already stated that he does intend to shake the hand of Pablo Mastroeni, this year's MLS coach, but anything could happen between now and then.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA News Feeds. voanews.com.
And when you visit voanews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog. I'm the guest blogger for the latest post titled Sierra Leone's Camara Builds Hope and an All-Star Resume. I write about the breakout season of Columbus Crew striker Kai Camara, as well as his work to help with the Ebola recovery efforts in his home country of Sierra Leone. Camara will be at the MLS All-Star Game in Denver, Colorado on Wednesday night after his league-leading 15 goals earned him a well-deserved selection. And another All-Star Game of sorts took place in the United States on Tuesday night as super clubs Barcelona and Chelsea played a friendly just outside of Washington, D.C., with Chelsea winning on penalties. A crowd of almost 80,000 saw a dazzling display from the two teams as Eden Hazard put Chelsea in front just after 10 minutes. But then in the second half, Luis Suarez, playing without regular strike partners Lionel Messi and Neymar, scored to tie the game. Each team would get one more goal each, meaning that penalties would decide the winner. And this time it was Chelsea who took the 4-2 shootout win. I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell. Back to you, Sonny.
Thanks, Jonah. Our African football guru, David Legg, joins us again this evening with the recent results in the CAF Champions League club competition.
The results, Sonny, Group A, Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco 1, Al Hilal of Sudan 1, and Smouha of Egypt 0, TP Mazembe of DR Congo 2. And in Group B, Anton Satif of Algeria, the holders, 1, Al Marek of Sudan 1, and USM Alger of Algeria 2, Maloudia El Elma of Algeria 1. Let's go back, Sonny, to Group A and look at the standings. Hilal and Mazembe have got 5 points each, Smouha 3 and Tetouan 2. And Hilal are top of the table because they have scored more goals than Mazembe, although both have got a +2 goal difference. A slightly different layout in Group B. Osma out in front with 9 points from 3 games. Marek and Satif have got 4 each and Ulma has none. And the reason Marek are ahead of Satif is goal difference. Marek are +1 and Satif are all square. In Group A, Sonny, the surprise packet have been Al Hilal of Sudan, and they've done it again. They've gone to Morocco. They fell behind 20 minutes from the end, but the Brazilian Andre Zeno equalized with 13 minutes left to give them a precious away point. And Hilal, who drew in Mazembe and also won at home against Smouha, are following the very clear-cut route to glory in Group A, and that is win at home and draw away. TP Mazembe, on the other hand, after 2 disappointing goalless draws, they won 2-0 at Alexandria. That's that ancient Egyptian city on the Mediterranean. Kalaba, the Zambian, scored after 40 minutes, and the Ghanaian, Ajay, got the crucial second goal 7 minutes from time. I think there's nobody more relieved in Africa tonight, Sonny, than Patrice Carteron, the French coach of Mazembe, because he has come under a lot of pressure, particularly after that home draw with Hilal. Mazembe are a multinational, expensively assembled squad. They've got Ghanaian stars, Malian stars, Zambian stars, Tanzanian stars, as well as several Congolese stars, and they include, of course, that man who never seems to get old, Robert Kidiaba, the goalkeeper with the ponytail and the bottom-bouncing tactic every time his side scored. So he was able to bounce around a bit at the weekend, Sonny, with those 2 goals. The big story in Group B is that Anton Satif of Algeria, the defending champions, they're struggling to make the semi-finals. They've got an awful home record. After drawing with Marek, it's now in the group stage. 1 win, 5 draws, and 2 losses. And that's really poor form. Just 1 victory at home in 8 matches. Against Marek, Ziaya scored after 16 minutes, but a Nigerian Jabison equalized just 6 minutes later. I saw some video clips of that match, Sonny, and the defending by Satif for the equalizing goal from Jabison was extremely poor. He had a free header from close range. In the other game, the success story so far of USM Alger continued, scored 2 goals within 22 minutes, and although they conceded one, they held on, and they've got a perfect record. 3 matches played, 3 victories.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. the Special Olympics World Games for intellectually disabled athletes is taking place this week in Los Angeles, California. The Democratic Republic of Congo sent four athletes to Los Angeles. The man who made their trip possible is the Congolese giant and Special Olympics Global Ambassador Dikembe Mutombo.
I'm very pleased to represent the nation of my birth, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the country that I've been represented for the first time in the Special Olympic game and the Special Olympic stage. For so long, Congo was not noticed in the Special Olympic. I've been in the boat almost for 7 years. Everyone was asking me, Dikembe, you've been very active raising money, raising the awareness about the Special Olympic in America and all around the world. How about your country? When we gonna see the kids from your country? And I told them, I said, I don't know where they are. I go to Congo every year. I build a $30 million hospital there with my foundation, and we never see these kids with intellectual disability coming to the hospital. They say, how come? Even at the hospital, you don't see them. I say, no. They say, I say, y'all give me a chance. I'm gonna find them. We'll make sure that they're in Los Angeles. So I started the process like a year and a half ago, start looking for them, and we just couldn't find them. We asked the people in the ministry, they didn't know where they were. We went to the social service, they said, we don't know, maybe some of the parents are hiding them in their houses. And we went to the Catholic Church. We asked them that, you guys have been a lot active here in the Congo for so many social issues. Do you know where we can find kids with intellectual disability? They said, well, we do. We got more than 2,500 of them in four different schools. Do you want to see them? And we went there. It was a bunch of kids from babies. I would say maybe 75% of those kids have been abandoned, have been dropped by the parents and don't come back. Because I come from the country where kids with intellectual disability are considered being a curse, like a taboo. I went and selected those kids and then we trained them, and my heart been full of joy. My wife and I and my three children are here. It's been a celebration for us, not just for my family, not just for the foundation, just for the country. And for these kids, I'm happy for them. I'm happy that they're becoming the global ambassador, international ambassador for a good cause in Africa.
That's the Congolese giant Dikembe Mutombo, a Special Olympics global ambassador. And Dikembe was speaking at the Special Olympics World Games in Los Angeles. And mark your calendar, VOA basketball fans. On September 11th, Dikembe Mutombo will be officially enshrined in the Basketball Hall of Fame. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to The Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, researchers working on a spinal cord implant that could one day restore movement in paralyzed individuals. And next, hundreds of Zimbabweans living in other countries are flocking home to register for dual citizenship. But first, some music. Here is Joel of Ghana with One Man Down.
Used to cruise me around in your car, but thank God I got my own home. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that. So why you the envy? Used to pay my bills before, but now I they pay for two. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that. Brother, man, still the envy. Unya yanka, that they be allowed in it, it's a petty baller. But man no be God, man no be God. Stop all the hating. Lie, lie, man just be man, so you never know why. My destiny changing, I'm living so high. Make you no envy, my son, be God when they bless me. Gunshots. One man down, on to the next one. Oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots. One man down, oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back. The DJ's
they playing my song. The fellas be loving, they hailing my song. The ladies, they dancing, they using my song for their ringtone. You never thought about that. No, I'm staring top forever. Whether you short or you tall, rich or you poor, time keep changing for better. And you can't do nothing about it. Another man ready no fighting. Because you know be God, and you never saw me past God. No one on yabala man. It does it when it feels just right. Don't you say it's never my type. So make you know they look down on another brother man. Ha. Let go. Gunshots.
One man down, on to the next one. Oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down. Oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots. One man down. Oh yeah, no gaba.
Said I would shrivel, said I'd be dead if I ever tried to whistle. But hey, who said it was simple? The feds take your bread so you wouldn't make a nickel. You mean I couldn't pick a pickle? Pick words when I could've picked a pistol. A sick verse, the other cells got him sickle. Blowing all up in your face like a pimple. Now he said, she said he ain't hit. And if he ain't hit, that's cause he ain't rich. And if he ain't rich, check who he came with. I don't play with this, he say and she say, shh. Get off my
one man crown, another man frown. Why, why? Because him want you down. They say one man crown, and another man frown. Why, why? Because him want you down. But guess what? Gunshots. One man down, on to the next one. Oh yeah, no gaba. Hey, another man down. Oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots. One man down. Oh yeah, no gaba.
Joel of Ghana with One Man Down.
Well, 500,000 people suffer spinal cord injuries each year due to car accidents, serious falls, and diseases, according to the World Health Organization. Researchers are now working on a spinal cord implant that could one day restore movement in paralyzed individuals. VOA's Maya Puchara reports.
6 weeks ago, this rat was unable to move. Its spinal cord completely severed. But it's walking today, held upright by a harness. Scientists in Switzerland developed an implant that supplies the rat's damaged spine with chemical and electrical stimulation that heals the nerves and restores movement. Stephanie Lacour, an assistant professor at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne, tested the implant and saw encouraging results.
By combining this electrochemical stimulation of the spinal cord tissue, we then tested whether or not we could restore locomotion in the hind limbs. And this is what we found, is that it, indeed, we can, using this technology, we were able over weeks of time to stimulate the spinal cord in spinal cord injured animals and allow them to walk.
This new implant, called eDura, is a flexible solution to inflamed tissue and damage caused by older technology. Stiff implants, which rubbed against the outermost layer of the rat's spinal cord.
We wanted an implant that could stay quite some time in vivo without inducing any detrimental effect. And so the first question we asked was, is soft making a difference?
She says it is. eDura is made of soft, stretchy but strong silicone that has two unique features. A microchannel allows researchers to inject drugs directly to the surface of the spinal cord for chemical stimulation. And stretchable platinum electrodes connected by gold tracks make the implant able to withstand big twists and turns as it stimulates spinal cord nerves electrically. eDura only restores involuntary movement. For the rat to be able to walk without a harness, the regenerated spinal cord nerves need to talk to the motor cortex, the part of the brain that controls voluntary movement.
There's no link at the moment between the brain, so the motor command, and the actual stimulation pattern on the spinal cord. So we now also have to find a way to link the two so that the person will think about moving and indeed the stimulation will be synchronized.
Creating this link in rats may be the next big leap in making eDura a safe and effective treatment for people who are bound to their wheelchairs, waiting to move again. Maya Pajara, VOA News, Washington.
Hundreds of Zimbabweans living in other countries are flocking home to register for dual citizenship, spelled out in the nation's new constitution and recent court rulings. Register General Tobaiwa Mudidi says his office cannot cope with the large number of passport applications from Zimbabweans in the diaspora. Reporter Gibbs Dube speaks to Alex Magasa of Kent University in London, one of the Constitution's authors.
The Constitution is clear, and the Constitutional Court, which is the highest court in the land, has made very clear decisions on dual citizenship. The position is that dual citizenship is permitted, and this has been accepted and recognized by the Constitutional Court in two cases, the case involving Mutuma Mawere in 2013 and another case involving Dr. Mazimba Muto in 2014. The only handicap is the office of the Registrar General, Mr. Tobaiwa Mudede, who, for whatever reason, seem to have their own law which they are applying, contrary to what the Constitution and Constitutional Court have ruled. I think that government has stepped in this regard, in particular the Minister of Justice, which is responsible for enforcing the laws, and also the Minister of Home Affairs, under which the Registrar General's office falls, to ensure that there is a clear enforcement of the Constitution and indeed enforcement of the Constitutional Court's rulings. Short of that, I would imagine that there is need for, unfortunately, another test case, which clearly requires the Registrar General to act in accordance with the rulings that have been passed by the Constitutional Court, failure of which he would be in contempt of court. But I would venture to say that he is already in contempt of court, because this is what the Constitutional Court has ruled, but they continue to ignore that rule.
Now, when you look at some of the demands that are being made by the RGS office, they're saying a person should be physically there to get a passport.
No, the point that we are making here is that there is what the law provides. But if what the law provides is hindered or made difficult to achieve by administrative mechanisms or means which are unreasonable, then that also needs to be challenged. And as I have said, if you look at the website of the Registrar General's office today, you will see there is actually a notice which says that your citizenship is prohibited. So they are giving a wrong impression to the public. But at the same time, they've also put in place administrative procedures for people who want to enforce the rights that are granted. And these administrative procedures are making it difficult for them to enforce their rights.
So does it mean that a person, let's say, living in America, Britain or Australia, can approach the embassies of Zimbabwe and actually put an application there for dual citizenship?
Well, you know what? The point here is this. The law recognizes that a Zimbabwean who is a Zimbabwean by birth is entitled to Zimbabwean citizenship. There is no way that you are going to make an application and say, I want to be a dual citizen. You simply apply for your passport. Now, if the state were to say that, do you hold any other passport? Of course, you say, yes, you do. Is it allowed in terms of the law? Nothing is not prohibited. And so if they say that you cannot get a passport because you hold an American or a British passport and you are a citizen by birth, then obviously they will be infringing your rights and you are entitled to challenge that.
So if they say you are a citizen by birth, what's the meaning here?
When we were doing the Constitution, we defined it broadly to mean not only a person who is born in Zimbabwe, on the soil of Zimbabwe, but it can be someone who is born outside Zimbabwe as long as they can prove that parent or at least one of the parents was ordinarily resident in Zimbabwe. They will also qualify as a birth.
So now give Zimbabweans advice, those that are living in the diaspora, about getting this dual citizenship.
People want advice, and if people are having challenges, they just simply need to obviously get legal advice. We can't via this medium, but it's important that, and to allay people's fears about dual citizenship, that the only reason why they are having difficulties is because of officials who are putting across administrative mechanisms or measures which are frustrating that process. But, you know, that requires engagement, like I said, with the government to ensure that the process is smoother and there are less difficulties than people are experiencing at the moment.
That was Alex Magaisa of Kent University speaking from London with reporter Gibbs Dube. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Mvunganyi, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Africa's continuing development is a top priority for the United States. Africa is a place of incredible dynamism, some of the fastest-growing markets in the world, extraordinary people, extraordinary resilience, said President Barack Obama. It has the potential to be the next center of global economic growth. There is little doubt that increasing trade is one of the fastest ways to promote economic growth, boost development, and reduce poverty. That is why 15 years ago, the United States initiated and passed into law the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. It is a trade preference program that eliminates import tariffs on most goods from eligible countries into the United States, thus easing the way for African products to enter U.S. markets. However, nations interested in participating in AGOA must first meet certain criteria set by the United States, including supporting market-based economies and the rule of law and protecting human rights. Since its inception in the summer of 2000, AGOA has created economic opportunities by supporting regional integration, helping African companies become more competitive, and fostering an enabling environment for private sector investment. It has created some 350,000 direct jobs and hundreds of thousands of indirect jobs. Over the years, AGOA has become the cornerstone of the U.S.-African economic relationship and has expanded U.S. trade and investment with eligible sub-Saharan African countries. AGOA was due to expire in September 2015, but on July 25th, with strong backing from the administration, the U.S. Congress extended the program for another 10 years, and 4 days later, President Obama signed the extension into law. Now that it's been renewed, AGOA will be central to our efforts to boost the trade and investment that supports hundreds of thousands of jobs, both in Africa and the United States, creating opportunities for all of us, said President Obama. And I'm especially pleased that AGOA will continue to encourage good governance and labor and human rights. That's something that we can be proud of. This year's AGOA Forum will be held in Libreville, Gabon, on August 26th through 27th, with the theme AGOA at 15, charting a course towards a sustainable U.S.-Africa trade and investment partnership. It will be preceded by events organized by civil society, the private sector, and the African Women's Entrepreneurship Program. The U.S. government wants to create shared prosperity with sub-Saharan Africa. Our continued commitment to AGOA is a hallmark of this effort.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.